Ryder Courtney knew that his stay in Khartoum was drawing to an end. Even if the relief column arrived before the city fell and was able to evacuate them all safely, the city would belong to the dervish. He was clearing out the compound, ready to pull out at the first opportunity. Rebecca had volunteered to help him draw up an inventory and bills of lading for everything that was being loaded on board the Intrepid Ibis. Ryder had become increasingly aware of the emotional turmoil she was going through. The uncertainty was wearing away at everyone's nerves as conditions in the city deteriorated. The menace of the great army of the dervish besiegers seemed to grow as the will of the trapped population declined and the relief column did not arrive. It had been 10 months since the city had been invested by the Mahdi, a long time to live under the threat of horrible death. Ryder knew how the responsibility of caring for her little sisters weighed upon Rebecca. Her father was little help in this regard. He was amiable and affectionate, but like the twins, he relied on her with almost childlike faith. None of the Sudanese women had returned to work since the mob attack on the compound. The running of the little greencake kitchen had devolved almost entirely upon Rebecca. The twins were willing helpers, but the grinding labour was beyond their strength and endurance. Ryder's admiration and affection for her were enhanced as he watched her struggle to take care of her family. He considered once again the fact, at barely 18, she had been saddled with this heavy load of responsibility. He understood how alone and isolated she felt, and tried to give her the help she needed. However, he was aware that his ill-considered, unrestrained behaviour had damaged her trust in him. He had to be careful not to frighten her again. Yet he longed to take her in his arms, comfort and shield her. He felt that since Penrod Ballantyne had left Khartoum, he had made good progress in repairing their damaged relationship. She seemed so much easier in his company. Their conversations were more relaxed, and she did not avoid him so obviously as before. They were in the blockhouse, sitting at his desk across from each other. They were counting the piles of silver dollars into heaps of 50, then wrapping them into rolls of parchment and packing them into wooden coffee chests, preparatory to taking them on board the Ibis. From the corner of his eye, Ryder watched her brush back a strand of that beautiful silken hair. His heart ached as he noticed the calluses on her hands and the little lines of worry and hardship at the corners of her eyes. A complexion like hers was more suited to the pleasant climes of England than to scorching sunlight and burning desert airs. "When this is over, I could sell up here and take her back to England," he thought. She looked up suddenly and caught his eyes upon her. "What would we do without you, Ryder?" she said. He was astonished by the words and the tone in which they were spoken. "My dear Rebecca, you would do well in any circumstances. I claim no credit for your strength and resolve." "I have been unkind to you," she ignored his denial. "I behaved like a little girl. You, of all people, I should have treated more kindly. Without you, we might long ago have perished." "You are being kind to me now. That makes up for everything," he said. "The green cake is just one of your valuable gifts to my family. I do not think it an exaggeration to say that with it you have saved our lives. We are healthy and strong in the midst of starvation and death. I can never repay you for that." "Your friendship is all the payment I could ask for." She smiled at him and the worry lines were smoothed away. He wanted to tell her how beautiful she was, but he bit back the words. She reached across the desk, spilling a stack of silver coins, and took his hand. "You are a good friend and a good man, Ryder Courtney." For the first time she studied his face quite openly. "He is not as beautiful as Penrod is," she thought. "But he has a strong, honest face. It's a face one could see every day and not grow tired of. He would never leave me, as Penrod has. There would be no native girls hiding in a back room. He is a man of substance, not ostentation or pretense. There would always be bread on his table. He is a rock of a man, and he would shelter his woman." The hand holding hers was powerful and competent, hardened with work. His bare arm reaching towards her was like the pillar of a house. His shoulders under the cloth of his shirt were broad and square. He was a man, not a boy. Then suddenly she remembered where they were. Her smile crumpled. The precariousness of their lives rushed back upon her. What would happen if Ryder sailed away in the Ibis and left her and the twins here? What would happen to them when the Mahdi and his murderous army stormed into the city? She knew what they did to the women they captured. Tears swamped her eyes and clung to her lashes. Oh, Ryder, what will become of us all? Are we all going to die in this awful place, dead before we have lived? She knew in her woman's heart that there was only one certain way that she could bind a man like him to herself forever. Was she ready to take that step? No, Rebecca, you have been so brave and strong for so long. Don't give up now. He stood up and moved quickly round the desk. She looked up at him as he stood over her, and the tears ran down her cheeks. "Hold me, Ryder. Hold me," she pleaded. "I do not want to give you offence again," he hesitated. "I was a child then, a mindless girl. Now I am a woman. Hold me like a woman." He lifted her to her feet and took her gently in his arms. "Be strong," he said. "Help me," she answered and pressed close to him. She buried her face against his chest and inhaled his scent. Her terrors and doubts seemed to recede into insignificance. She felt safe. She felt his strength flowing into her and clung to him with quiet desperation. Then slowly she was aware of a new, pleasant sensation that seemed to emanate from the center of her being. It was not the divine and consuming madness that Penrod Ballantyne had evoked. It was rather a warming glow. This man she could trust. She was safe in his arms. It would be easy to do what she had contemplated. "This is something I must do not only for myself but for my family." Silently she made the decision, then said aloud, "Kiss me, Ryder." She lifted her face to him. "Kiss me as you did before." "Rebecca, my darling Becky, are you sure what you're about?" "If you can speak only to ask daft questions," she smiled at him, "then speak not at all. Just kiss me." His mouth was hot, and his breath mingled with hers. Her lips were soft, and she felt his tongue slip between them. Once that had frightened and confused her, but now she revelled in the taste of him. "I will take him as my man," she thought. "I reject the other. I take Ryder Courtney." With that level-headed decision, she let her emotions take control. She slipped the leash on all restraint as she felt something clench deep in her belly. It was a sensation so powerful that it reached the edge of pain. She felt it throbbing inside her. "It is my womb," she realized with amazement. "He has roused the center of my womanhood." She pushed her hips hard against his, trying to ease the pain, or aggravate it, she was not certain which. The last time Ryder had embraced her, she had not understood what she had felt swelling and hardening. Now she knew. This time she was not afraid. She even had a secret name for that man's thing. She called it a tammy, after the tamarind tree outside her bedroom, which Penrod had climbed that first night. "His tammy is singing to my quimmy," she thought, "and my quimmy likes the tune." Her mother, the emancipated Sarah Isabel Benbrook, had taught her the quaint word. "This might be the last day of our lives. Do not waste it," she breathed. "Let us take this moment, hold it, and never let go." But he was diffident. She had to take his hands and place them on her breasts. Her nipples seemed to swell and burn with his touch. She twisted the fingers of one hand into the hair of the back of his head to pull it down, and with the other hand she opened the hooks down the front of her bodice. She freed one of her breasts, and as it popped out she pressed it into his mouth. She cried out with the sweet pain of his teeth on her tender flesh. Her essence welled inside her and overflowed. She was overcome with a desperate sense of urgency. "Quickly, please, Ryder, I am dying. Do not let me die. Save me." She knew she was babbling nonsense, but she did not care. She clasped both her arms around his neck and tried to climb up his body. He reached behind her, took a double handful of the hem of her skirt, and lifted it up around her waist. She wore nothing beneath it, and her buttocks were pale and round as a pair of ostrich eggs in the gloom of the shuttered room. He cupped them in his hands and lifted her. She locked her thighs round his hips and felt him burrowing into the silken nest of curls at the fork of her legs. "Quickly! I cannot live another moment without you inside me." She pressed down hard, screwing up her eyes with the effort, and felt all her resistance to him give way. She dug her fingernails into his back and pushed down again. Then nothing else in the world mattered. All her worries and fears dissolved as he glided in, impaling her deeply. She felt her womb open to welcome him. She thrust again, with a kind of barely controlled desperation. She felt his legs begin to tremble and stared into his face as it contorted in ecstatic agony. She felt his legs juddering beneath them, and she thrust harder and faster. He opened his mouth, and when he cried out, her voice echoed his. They locked each other in a fierce paroxysm that seemed as if it would bind them together through eternity. But at last their voices sank into silence, and the rigid muscles of his legs relaxed. He sank to the floor on his knees, but she clung to him desperately, clenching herself round him so that he could not slip out and leave her empty. He seemed to return at last from a faraway place and stared at her with an expression of awe and wonder. "Now you are my woman?" It was halfway between a question and a declaration. She smiled at him tenderly. He was still deep inside her. She felt marvellously powerful, deliciously lascivious and wanton. She tightened her loins and gripped hard. She had not realised she was capable of such a trick. He gasped, and his eyes flew wide. "Yes," she agreed, "and you are my man. I will hold you like this forever, and never let you go." "I am your willing captive," he said. She kissed his lips. When she broke off to draw breath, he went on. "Will you do me the great honour of becoming my wife? We do not want to shock the world, do we?" Suddenly it was all happening very swiftly. Although this had been her intention, she could not think of a response, both demure and yet binding, upon him. While she considered it, there was a loud knock on the blockhouse door. She pushed him away and hurriedly stuffed her breasts back into her bodice, looking anxiously towards the door. "It is locked," he reminded her in a whisper. With hundreds of pounds in coin lying on his desk, he had taken no chances. Now he raised his voice. "Who is it?" "It is I, Bakshit. I have brought a news bulletin from Gordon Pasha." "That is not important enough to worry me when I am busy," Ryder retorted. Gordon issued his bulletins almost daily. They were designed to comfort the populace of the city and to bolster their will to resist. Thus his compositions were subject to wide literary license, and were often separated from the truth by a considerable distance. "This one is important, Effendi." Bakshit's tone was excited. "Good news, very good news." "Push it under the door," Ryder ordered. He stood up and lifted Rebecca to her feet. They both adjusted their clothing. He buttoned the front of his breeches, and she straightened her skirts. Then Ryder went to the door and picked up the crudely printed bulletin. He scanned it, then brought it to her. "Dervish army routed. The road to Khartoum is open. British relief column will arrive within days." She read it twice, the first time swiftly, the second deliberately. At last she looked up at him. "Do you think it is the truth this time?" "It will be a cruel hoax if it is not. But Chinese Gordon is not renowned for his restraint or his consideration for the delicate feelings of others." Rebecca pretended to reread the bulletin, but her mind was racing. If the relief column was truly on its way, was the need for a permanent relationship with Ryder Courtney still so pressing? As his wife, she would be doomed to spend the rest of her days in this wild, savage land. Would she ever again see the green fields of England and have the society of civilized people? Was there any desperate urgency to marry a man who was pleasant and would care for her, but whom she did not love? "True or not," Ryder went on, "we shall find out very soon. One way or the other, you will still be my fiancée. There is a full head of steam in the Ibis's boiler, and her hold is loaded with every stick of cargo it can carry." He broke off and studied her face quizzically. "What is it, my darling? Is something worrying you?" "I have not yet replied to your question," she said softly. "Oh, if that is all, then I shall repeat it and hope for your formal response," he said. "Will you, Rebecca Helen Benbrook, take me, Ryder Courtney, to be your lawful wedded husband?" "In all truth, I do not know," she said. And he stared at her, appalled. "Please give me a little time to think upon it. It is a momentous decision, and not one I can rush into." In this pivotal moment on which so much depended, a thought suddenly occurred to her. If the relief column arrives the day after tomorrow, will Penrod Ballantyne be with them? Then she thought, it is of no account, one way or the other, for he no longer means anything to me. I made a mistake in trusting him. But now he can go back to his Arab girls and his philandering ways, for all I care. But she found herself unconvinced by this, and the image of Penrod persisted in her mind long after she had left Ryder's compound and was on her way back to the consular palace.